Hearing Committee for Tuesday, April 17, 2007. Members, we've got a long agenda, and to get accustomed to it, because that's what we're going to be seeing here probably until the end of the month. We'll be taking the agenda in the order in which it's printed, and just by my count, that is going to leave us with, on average, about 15 minutes plus per bill. So I'm hoping to that we can get to the heart of each matter quickly and get ourselves informed and make decisions. That's on this 2908, which is between 8:30 and 9:30. So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2310. Council Calmonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2310 clarifies the rights of judgment creditors who have obtained a charging order against the interest of a member of a limited liability company. The bill permits a court to appoint a receiver of any distributions due to the judgment debtor and to make all other orders that the circumstances may require. The bill establishes that a charging order is a lien on the debtor's distributional interest in the LLC and has priority over later charging orders. It also permits a court to order a foreclosure of the member's distributional interest at any time. The bill clarifies that a distributional interest subject to a charging order may be redeemed by the judgment debtor or other members of the LLC, and it applies to charging orders entered on or after the effective date of the Act. There are also -1 amendments to this bill which clarify that the provisions in ORS Chapter 18 for executing on intangible personal property apply to the foreclosure of a distributional interest in an LLC.
Thank you, counsel. And I see the first person signed up is James Brewer. Is that who I'm looking at?
Yes, it is.
Very good. Mr. Brewer.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Brewer. I am from Corvallis, and I feel wildly underdressed because my tie is the wrong tie. go Beavs. I'm a lawyer in Corvallis. I represent a man named John Wydronek. Mr. Wydronek is here today, and he's just told me that to respect your time, he's not going to testify today, although he did sign in. Essentially, Mr. Wydronek is a person who loaned someone some money. That person's only valuable asset was a share of a limited liability company. Mr. Wydronek had the foresight to get a judgment in his favor. He did get a charging order. Once he had the charging order, instead of being able to touch that interest in the limited liability company, the debtor gave a whole series of other creditors charging orders as well. The Benton County Circuit Court, which is a great court, did a careful job of looking at the statute and had a great deal of difficulty figuring out what to do with competing charging orders. What we've asked you to do and what the bill does is bring the statute in line with the Uniform Act. It also brings it in line with the enforcement provisions for limited liability partnerships. And that's what we'd ask you to do.
Mr. Brewer, for my benefit, and I'm sure it'd be helpful to the rest of the committee, describe a charging order and how that works.
If a person, limited liability companies, are not a tangible asset. They're an intangible asset. They don't have stock. They don't have certain other things that other companies might have. What they do have is the ability to distribute funds to their members from time to time. A judgment creditor can seek a charging order from the court. As far as I know, they're used only in limited liability companies, limited liability partnerships, and possibly in S corporations. And it is an order from the court that when a distribution is made from that company to a member, it should be paid to the creditor rather than to the member.
So it might draw an analogy to a garnishment, for
example.
That's
correct.
A garnishment applies to wages. A charging order is on another kind of distributional interest of income, but it doesn't have to be salary or wages.
I think that's a very good analogy, yes,
okay.
Sir.
Okay, very good. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brewer, there's some proposed amendments to this bill. Have you seen those?
I have seen those. I think I actually proposed one, and the other one that I've seen I also don't think is a particular problem. Our interest, maybe the one I proposed is not there.
Mr. Brewer, I have a C-1 amendment.
Dash
is there
one.
Another amendment?
I've seen dash one over here. I sent an amendment to Mr. Kelmanson by email some time ago, and it may simply not be here.
Yeah, all we have are the dash ones.
Okay.
So.
And do you have any objection to those?
No, I don't.
And I can just clarify. The dash ones, I sent the bill around to some people, and they said it just would help to clarify that, just to spell out how it is you would foreclose on something according to Chapter 18.
I read the dash one this morning, and it actually is helpful.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Mr. Brewer, I'm going to suggest you remain seated there, and we've got another witness signed up in opposition, Bill Brewer from Lane County, and I'm going to invite
that. We are not related, but he's a lovely person and has a great last name.
we had a family feud going on here, but... Mr. Bill Brewer, if you could just take a seat there and tell us what your perspective on this bill is.
Well, let me say I feel a little outnumbered here coming from Eugene and seeing all these Beaver fans here.
There are good people in bad places.
I'm here as a member of the estate planning section of the Oregon State Bar. Our section voted to oppose this bill, and we have basically two reasons for opposing it. Number one, we think it will upset the rights of debtors and creditors that was originally in the legislation when it was passed. And we also think it's going to create a lot of problems going forward because there's undefined terms in there that create unspecified rights. And the courts are going to have to resolve those rights. In our estate planning practices, we represent a lot of small businesses, which as a estate planning tool can use, want to bring the younger family members into their LLCs, their business entities, which LLCs have become the business entity of choice in Oregon. They want to bring younger generation in, but they don't want the LLC to be responsible for the debts that the younger family members might incur. So if you're the founder of a business and you're thinking about bringing your young child into the business as an equity owner, you want to be sure that the business is not going to be jeopardized by doing that. And the problem with this legislation is that it could force innocent LLC members to pay the debts of debtor members. And that's the problem, because if the debtor member forecloses, if the creditor forecloses on the debtor member's interest, and then has the rights of a transferee, and the statute doesn't, or the bill does not say what a transferee's rights are, but it says that they have the rights of a transferee, then presumably that creditor is going to try to use that foreclosed membership interest to leverage that to interfere in the affairs of the LLC. And it'll force the innocent members of the LLC or the LLC entity itself to buy out that creditor's claim. And that's...
Okay, let me just probe that a bit. I mean, the analogy I would draw is to a corporation where the ownership interests in which are represented by stock, and a creditor of a shareholder can foreclose on that stock and take possession of the stock and then have whatever rights are associated with being a shareholder. Why wouldn't it work the same way in an LLC? That is, a person who forecloses on a distributional interest in an LLC would have only those rights that a member in an LLC, that is an owner of the LLC, has, that is to receive income, rather than being able, as I think you're saying, that they can interfere with the operation of the LLC so that the other members, the other owners of the LLC, would be forced to buy them out to get rid of this disruptive interest. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, let me start by saying that there's a difference between corporations and LLCs. A corporation is owned by its shareholders, but they don't manage the LLC. shareholders' rights are limited to electing a board of directors, and the board of directors then appoints the officers who are the managers of the corporation. In an LLC, a member has management rights. It's a very different thing. The LLC is a combination of partnership law and corporation law. Corporations have limited liability, but they have unfavorable tax characteristics. A partnership has no limited liability, but has favorable tax characteristics. In 1993, the legislation was enacted in Oregon that combined the best features of both the corporation and the LLC. And that is a different animal than a corporation. If you get a hold of corporate stock, the most you're getting is the right to elect the board of directors. And if what you have is a minority interest in that stock, you can't elect the director. So if you have a business that's organized as a corporation, you allow your child to have some stock in it, the worst interference you're going to face is a dissenting vote when it comes time to elect the board of directors. On the other hand, with an LLC, there are management rights that go with being a member in the LLC. And if you can exercise those management rights, for instance, you can obligate the LLC to take actions. The signature of a managing member is binding on the LLC. So it's a very different animal. And the this legislation would upset that cart. In addition, this legislation talks about a distributional interest. There is no definition of a distributional interest in the LLC statutes. I don't know what a distributional interest is. It also talks about the rights of a transferee, and there's no definition in the LLC statute of what a transferee is. So I'm not sure what rights the foreclosing creditor gets when the statute says they get the rights of a transferee. And the only way that's going to be resolved is in court, and it's going to lead to expensive and complex litigation.
Mr. Brewer, number one, do we get a response from you to those?
Well, currently, the statutory scheme does allow for charging orders against LLCs. It does allow for charging orders against the distributional interest in an LLC. So we already have a term in the statute that is not defined, and in fact that has led, at least in Mr. Wydronik's case, to litigation. And the effect of that charging order is supposed to be an assignment, again, without particularly good definitions within the statutory scheme for what the effect of that assignment would be. It may very well be that many LLCs, all members have management rights, but not in all LLCs. In a vast number of LLCs, I would expect that the LLC formation documents themselves delineate a particular person as the managing member. I certainly understand Mr. Brewer's concerns, and perhaps one compromise would be to make a distinction between single member LLCs and other LLCs for these purposes.
Would it meet your needs if this were limited to single member LLCs?
Actually, it would meet our needs if it were not, if single member LLCs were excluded from this.
That doesn't seem like it's responsive to Mr. Bill Brewer's concerns. I mean, he's concerned about having, when you have multi-member LLCs, having new bedfellow that you didn't invite into the bed.
Yeah. I don't know if there's a particularly good answer for that. I know that the situation Mr. Wydronik found himself in was with a minority member of an LLC who did not have management rights and did have a valuable asset which could not be reached.
Committee members, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bill Brewer, I want to start by assuring you that there is a University of Oregon Day later in the session, and I hope you'll join us for that. You heard Mr. Jim Brewer's description of what happened to his client and the competing charging orders. I must say that I'm very concerned about changing the with this bill, the ability to limit liability of members of an LLC, but I wonder if you could suggest if there's some other way that his client's concern could be addressed to deal with the competing charging orders and without changing the limit of liability for LLCs.
Thank you for saying that there's a U of O Day. I'm actually a graduate of Willamette University. I don't know if there's a Willamette Day.
Every day. Right. So.
Every day is a Willamette Day.
But I'm not familiar with Mr. James Brewer's case, but the thing about a membership interest in an LLC where the member has no management rights is that's probably not a very valuable interest unless there are distributions being made from the LLC. If there are distributions being made from the LLC, then the charging order diverts those distributions to the creditor. So I don't believe that the charging order is the problem here. It appears to me that the problem that Mr. James Brewer's client ran into was that there is no ordering of the priority of the creditors who get the charging order. And in most areas of law, it seems to me that the first creditor in line should get the priority. That's the way lien law works. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that if I understand this situation correctly, and believe me, I have no knowledge of it, that if Mr. Brewer's creditor had been able to take advantage of a ordering priority, then he would have been first in line to get the diverted distributions from the LLC until his debt was paid, and the later creditors would have had to stand in line and wait for his debt to be paid. That strikes me as the appropriate response. I'm surprised that that's in question, but I don't doubt that it is. I've never run into the situation personally.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Thank you. So am I hearing that you're okay with a portion of the bill that talks about priority? It's just the rest of it that you have a problem with?
Yeah, I mean, I, to me, the charging order is an appropriate remedy, and if there's a problem with the charging order in that we don't know how to operate it, we should clarify that. That doesn't mean we should move to a foreclosure. I believe I'm correct, James, that in fact was the problem, that there is no ordering of priority.
That's correct.
If that's the case, I have no problem with setting a priority, and in fact, I guess I express surprise that isn't obvious in the current legislation, but I had never run into it. Frankly, this is a fairly rare situation, I suspect. There's not a lot of people here testifying because there's not a lot of incidences where this occurs. And so I think that is instructive in and of itself.
What would be, although it is a technical issue, I would say with the tremendous increase in the number of LLCs as a preferred form of business entity, I think that increasingly these kinds of issues are going to come forward. So I, what I'm going to suggest to the two of you is if it's possible to work up a consensus product, that would be, I think, most instructive to the committee, but recognize there's very limited time to get that done because we are to complete our work on House bills but before the end of the month. So I'm going to suggest that you see if you can work out something that would be a consensus product that could be brought back in another day.
Yep. Representative Cameron. Mr. Chair, thank you. And I think that's real important that Representative Bonamici's bringing up the question of what we need to do to solve this. I would hesitate to do anything that would trigger foreclosure on LLC members. I think we're really treading on some big policy changes in the state of Oregon. However, a priority of how those debts need to be paid off on a charging order makes common sense to me. So I think that if we could come up with some solution like that, it would be something we could take a look at. But the way this bill is written, I don't think is a good thing.
Okay. Very good. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2310. And because no one has signed up to testify, and because I've learned that there's a caucus meeting at 9:45, I'm going to skip over for now House Bill 2833 and move to House Bill 2853. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2853.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2853 establishes that a person may not acquire property by adverse possession if it is owned by a railroad or used by a railroad operation.
And we have Representative Morgan here to introduce this bill to us.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Morgan, and I'm state rep from House District Number 2. House Bill 2853 was filed at my request for Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad, which is a short line railroad in my district. And the railroad, and I think many railroads in the state, are facing issues of the integrity of the easements to put their tracks on. And so I am not going to go any farther into the details of the bill than that. There are people here that will answer your questions in far greater detail than I can. But I do thank you very much for this opportunity to hear the bill.
Very good. Thank you, Representative. And I've got several people here signed up. That's Jane Gates, Kevin Spraglin, and Ken Messerly. So why don't you all three come up together?
Yates must be Yates.
Yates? Oh, I'm sorry. Beg your pardon. Jane Yates.
Morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ken Messerly, a lobbyist for Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad. With me today is the brand new manager of Central Oregon Pacific, Kevin Spraglin, and he will make a few comments. And then we have Jane Yates, who is our legal counsel, and she will have testimony for you. There are also others signed up, I believe, from other companies, rail companies, to testify this morning. And I just wanted to point out also that this is not specific to Central Oregon and Pacific. This is a industry-wide problem. So with that, I will turn this over to Kevin Spraglin, the general manager of Central Oregon and Pacific.
Very good. Spraglin.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Kevin Spraglin. I'm general manager of the Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad. Our short line railroad covers the area from Eugene, where we interchange with the Union Pacific, to Coquille, running through Coos Bay. And we also have a line that runs from Eugene south to an interchange point with the Union Pacific again at Black Butte, California. We believe this bill is important to our railroad as well as the industry and the shipping public, as it will help protect the uninterrupted flow of goods by rail. And we ask your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spraglin. Ms. Yates?
I would like to do whatever is most efficient for you, and I can read you my written testimony, or I can just give you a brief overview, or I could just answer any questions. I'm not sure if you had an opportunity to
I think
to
it might be helpful I'm not sure how well the committee understands sort of adverse possession and how what happens, how property rights can be lost as a result of adverse possession. So maybe just a quick, very brief summary of that for the committee.
Well, in Oregon, basically, adverse possession is a squatter's rights. If an individual enters onto private property and maintains a continuous presence there for 10 years, they can obtain an outright property right, regardless of what the initial ownership was. So in this particular instance, the railroad has a right-of-way. Some of that right-of-way was granted through congressional grant. There is common law and case law that says that the right-of-way that's granted through congressional grant can't be obtained through adverse possession, but there's also portions of the right-of-way that were given through private deeds. If there was a landowner that was in place before the railroad came through, then those pieces of property are actually owned outright by the railroad.
And I'm gathering that there are significant numbers of railroad lines that are not in active use with rails on them, but there's a corridor that may be revived for future use. Is that the problem?
No, these are active rail lines. Generally, corridors that are abandoned by the railroad fall under the jurisdiction of the Surface Transportation Board, and if private property owners want to obtain rights on those pieces of property, there's an administrative procedure for them to go through with the federal government.
So what would this bill then affect? Is it people who are encroaching on the edges of the well, there's still trains using the railroad right-of-way, but people are encroaching across the edges of it?
That's correct.
I see.
And there's also instances, too, where there are this bill actually came up because there's some instances where There are a lot of unlicensed private crossings in the state of Oregon. And property owners are asserting that they've got a right to use those crossings instead of executing a license agreement with the railroad. And the problem is that a license agreement allows liability to be apportioned to the user of the crossing, whereas if you have an adverse claim, the liability is the responsibility of the railroad, and in turn that goes down the chain of commerce to the end consumer.
Yes, Mr. Chair. You have a question, Representative Wisner?
Thank you. Yes, I have a community that I've been dealing with for a couple of years. They have that same situation. The only way to get into their community of about 100 homes is across the railroad track when they can't find the easement authority. So is there going to be any protection for them as far as sunset?
Well, the railroad doesn't have any interest in barring property owners from their property. Their interest is in getting property owners who use private crossings to execute license agreements with them so that it's clear who bears responsibility, it's clear who bears maintenance for those crossings. And they can also maintain safety integrity, too. As far as if you've got 100 homes, I'm not certain that that would be considered a private crossing. That's likely would be considered a public crossing, and I believe that that falls under the jurisdiction of the Oregon Department of Transportation.
I don't think this one does. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Yates. I feel like I'm missing something here because I understand that what your goal is to make sure that the people using the private crossings have license agreements. But what this statute does is prohibits anybody from acquiring property by adverse possession, which it's been a long time, but I remember it's 10 years of sort of
notorious.
Open and notorious being on the property, and I'm having trouble connecting the problem with the remedy that's in the statute.
Well, there are actually two separate problems. One is the adverse possession, which is the railroad can actually lose a portion of its right-of-way, and then the second is a prescriptive easement claim, which the railroad wouldn't necessarily lose the underlying property, but would lose they would lose control over how they administer that right-of-way.
So, follow-up?
Go ahead.
So, are there people living on the railroad track or on the proper side of the property that for 10 years? I'm just having trouble putting this adverse possession remedy onto the...
The right-of-way varies in width throughout the state of Oregon. And there are a lot of situations where people are using the right-of-way. If as long as that use doesn't interfere with the railroad operations, I don't believe there's any objection to it being used, but the risk of losing that property when that right-of-way can be developed at some future point to provide possibly passenger train service or some other transportation use is a risk, and that right-of-way needs to be maintained, and its integrity needs to be maintained.
Excuse me, could I add to that a little bit, Representative? We have seen instances in the past where we do have encroachment up along the right-of-way, almost to the end of the tie or right up next to the track, and our concern is if that goes on for a period of time unnoticed, unchecked, we could actually lose that property. And that's where some of the safety issues come in for us as far as not having buildings, people, things that close to the active rail line.
So, Cameron.
Yeah, just so I get a clear picture, I'm just thinking of a rail line that's going through someplace. A rancher builds his fence up to maybe 10 feet to that rail line or 15 feet, but the easement might be 40 or 60 feet, so that someday you're going, hey, I want to build a passing rail here, and that rancher's had his fence line up to there, and he's 30 or 40 feet into the easement. This is what we're trying to protect, so you'd be able to come back and be able to do that as freight grows and those types of things.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
If there are no further questions for this panel, let's bring up a couple more here and we get another couple other perspectives. Why don't we bring up together Robert Grossman and Roger Martin. And
Mr. Grossman's first on the list, so if it, unless there's a logic to otherwise, then would
no.
Mr. Grossman, let's just start.
He came from further away.
I'm Robert Grossman. I'm an officer of the Willamette and Pacific and Portland and Western Railroads. Those are sister railroads and run from Astoria down to Portland, down to Salem, down to Eugene, and branch lines out to the western part of the state. So we have 500 miles in the state. We have 1,100 crossings on our railroad, 475 which are private crossings. And this is a problem. I view it mainly as a safety issue, that getting near the trains run on short lines 30 miles an hour. On the major railroads, they may run 70 miles an hour. And a train cannot stop like a car or a truck in a matter of feet. Could take sometimes a half a mile or longer to stop. So people going across our railroad that's not a public or a licensed private crossing are at risk. Most of our accidents happen on railroads at crossings, deaths and injuries, and also trespassers. That's where most of the accidents in the industry happen. So this is really, we look at it as a safety issue besides the property rights issue, and we're regulated by the STB, Surface Transportation Board, federally. We're in state commerce, and we cannot have impediments to operating our trains and serving customers along the way. So this is both a commercial issue that we have continuous right of way with no obstructions, and I view it mainly as a safety issue because we battle this every day. And then having a license agreement with somebody, and we allow crossings, but it gives the who's liable for it, who has to maintain it, and so forth. And it should not be the railroad's obligation to maintain a crossing for a single house or something that, or somebody that wants to get across our railroad. So the license agreement lays out all the parameters of protections and so forth between the parties.
Okay, Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, even though I'm a strong duck, I'm happy to be here today because my sport was baseball, and that's the sport I support at Oregon State. It's nothing to do with the bill. I represent the Union Pacific Railroad, and we strongly support House Bill 2853. Robert Grossman has outlined the crossing issue. We have a little incident in eastern Oregon where, ironically, a former Union Pacific employee retired. He bought one of our line shacks or the houses that were used by crews in former times from us. The access is on our crossing, which is our own railroad crossing, to get to those line shacks and to our siding. And he's been constantly in touch with every politician in eastern Oregon trying to make that a public crossing for his benefit. And the company's wondering why they ever sold him the shack. Union Pacific and all railroads are under a lot of pressure from the Oregon Department of Transportation and from every legislative committee we appear before. Last night we had a railroad function. Several of you were there. One of the first questions that comes up is, when can you double track your rail from Portland to California and from Portland to Idaho east-west? We maintain a right-of-way. We probably don't have the same problem some of the short lines do because our right-of-ways are in active use all the time. Many of the right-of-ways on some of the short lines are not used very often, and this adverse possession, for exactly the reasons Representative Cameron mentioned, people have over time fenced up, moved up close to the right-of-way. The right-of-ways are larger than just the track and the embankment that is around it. They often go out 100 and some feet, and we need to protect that because we absolutely, if we're going to solve the traffic problems of Oregon, are going to have to build what you want, double track, and use more of that right of way, and we don't want to get in a legal battle every time we have to widen it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Jim Cameron.
Mr. Martin, I just want to mention that Beaver Day has a lot to do with this bill and the fact that there is a train running right through the middle of the campus at Oregon State University, so don't forget that.
I never will.
Committee, unless there are further questions, I think it's time for us to act on this bill rather than hear more input on it. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2853 and open a work session on House Bill 2853. Representative Krieger.
Can you, Mr. Chair, have counsel talk to us about the Dash 1 amendments?
I don't have any.
The Dash 1 is supposed to be part of this, Senator.
Do you have any?
No, I don't have them. Didn't think we had any Dash 1s.
No. Was it the original bill that they wanted to move? That's what I needed to know.
Yeah, I was unaware that there were any amendments.
All right.
So,
Do you have them?
Yeah, I'm going to call the Representative Morgan. Are you aware of any Dash 1 amendments we should be considering?
There are no amendments.
That's what I thought. And the bill is pretty simple.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I'm sorry. I was not pre-briefed or given any advanced information on this, and I've got to be clear that I understand what we're doing here. I do have a community that we have a real problem in a crossing, and I don't understand. What I'm reading here is if they sign an agreement waiving the risk and everything that the line is okay, we're not going to be closing that access. It's the only access into this community. And I want to be sure that that's not going to be closed. Do they have, you know, how do we initiate the agreement? I was not pre-briefed on this at all. I'm sorry. And
I think that it really is a different issue.
Yes.
In that
yes.
You know, what this bill deals with is
the testimony from Mrs. Yates talks about a license agreement, private crossing established under adverse claims the same as that the state cannot extinguish such a claim, the rate cannot close such a crossing if it interferes with the rail operation of safety, correct?
Well, that would only, Ms. Yates, why don't you come up and respond?
The written testimony was to give you a background of the bigger picture of what the railroads are facing. This bill in particular has nothing to do with crossings or any right of access to private property.
Only the easements along the track.
It only has to do with adverse possession and the possibility that a squatter could obtain title to a railroad right-of-way.
And the more important point, Representative, is that it deals with rights that come about only as a squatter, things you do without permission, and then if you do them for 10 years, you own that. You've captured other people's property, whereas licensing for crossings is a whole other process that people would go through.
Okay, I take your point, Mr. Chair, but that's not the testimony confuses me and talks about agreements and stuff.
Can I ask a quick question and hope to clarify this? For Representative Wisnett, in a situation like in Representative Wisnett's district where there's a housing community and the only access is over a railroad, is it likely that they already have a license agreement?
I would believe so, yes. And I would also...
We couldn't find it.
It's not...
They couldn't find it.
I would suggest that they contact the railroad. The railroad may have a copy of it, or it could be recorded in the county records.
It's along 97 near Lapine.
I would just add, if you have a situation where there's a license agreement, you couldn't, almost by definition, have an adverse possession claim because it has to be hostile, it has to be exclusive. There's all these requirements that you couldn't have. It's really only what Representative Cameron was saying when you have a right-of-way and there's a fence or something. So it wouldn't apply to that particular situation. But I agree, though, the testimony does talk about that. But that's not really what this bill would deal with.
It's a different issue.
Mr. Chair, for the sake of time, I'd like to make a motion to move the bill, if we can.
Go ahead.
I move the House Bill 2853 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2853 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of the motion? If not, the clerk call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Courtesy, yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 2853 moves to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. And Representative Krieger, Representative Morgan is first as sponsor.
Representative Morgan is a sponsor.
If Representative Morgan, if you would carry the bill, I'd appreciate that.
Very good.
And if there's something that could be done in the meantime to lay the concerns that were expressed here about licensing in that particular situation, I think that would be very good. Thank you very much. I'll close the work session of House Bill 2853 and we're going to open a public hearing now on House Bill 2908. And we have some folks who need to be connected by telephone here to participate.
No.
That's what we're doing now.
Is this your point? Why don't we go ahead with the staff summary here now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2908 requires insurance companies to pay insureds up to the limits of their policy when the insured sustains an injury from an accident with an uninsured car, even if the uninsured car was owned or operated by a public body or employee who is subject to the Tort Claims Act.
much to that.
Is this Opal Shipman? This is the judiciary calling in Salem, and I'm connecting you to a conference call. Just a moment. Are you both there?
Yeah, I wasn't on the judiciary.
I know it.
Okay. Now, would we have Kelly Anderson and Opal Shipman on the line?
Kelly Anderson is present.
Very good. And Opal Shipman? Hello?
Kelly?
Yes.
There
they are.
Is Opal there? I can hear Opal.
She's on the line. Okay. And Opal, so why don't you speak up so we can find out whether we can hear you. Ms. Shipman?
Okay.
Okay, very good. Well, we've heard just a very brief summary from council to the committee. We're just so you had to understand the scene, we're here in hearing room 357 in the Capitol, and we've got a committee of 9 members here around the dais, and there are 20 or so people in the audience. So go ahead, Mr. Anderson, and just tell us more about House Bill 2908.
Thank you very much. Several years ago, I represented Mrs. Shipman. She was a pedestrian and was run over in a crosswalk by a Klamath Transit District bus. Among the other injuries that she suffered was the amputation below the knee of one foot and severe tendon damage to the other foot. We submitted a package for medical bills and medical records to the Transit District's insurance adjuster, and he acknowledged that, in his opinion, the case was probably worth between $700,000 and $800,000. But he explained that the Transit District was entitled to the tort limit of government entities of $200,000. And we acknowledged the correctness of his position, and then, after accepting the $200,000, made a claim on Ms. Shipman's own insurance company, Allstate, for an additional $300,000. For years, she had carried uninsured motorist coverage of $500,000. What we discovered, and this was news to me, was that the Court of Appeals had decided the case several years before, Surplus versus American Spirit Insurance Company, in which the court, construing current Oregon law, concluded that she was not entitled to recover any more than the tort limit against the government defendant. And so the $500,000 insurance policy that she had was of absolutely no value to her. And if she had been allowed to collect what she had paid many years of premiums to have, it wouldn't have cost the taxpayers anything, and in fact would benefit the taxpayers in two different accounts. One is that Medicare paid some of her medical bills, and because of the nature and extent of her injuries, Medicare eventually waived its reimbursement of $38,000. And that, of course, cost the taxpayer something. The other thing is if she had been able to collect the other $300,000, the difference between the $200,000 that she did collect and the $500,000 above her own insurance policy limit, then she would have a reserve that she could support herself on in future years. As it is, before her injury, she lived alone and independent. She drove her car. Her rent was about $400 a month. Now she's paying $2,400 in an assisted living facility because she's no longer mobile because of the foot injury and the other injuries that she suffered. And at $2,400 a month, that's $2,000 more than she was having to pay. So $2,000 a month times 12 months is $24,000 a year. and her net proceeds, that $200,000 settlement, will probably not last her for her life expectancy, and at some point there will be a taxpayer burden. And reversing legislatively the court decision, which was never intended, I'm sure, by the legislature when the original statute was drafted, would save the taxpayers' money in the long run and would place the responsibility for the harm on the insurance company that for years she paid premiums to. So for this reason, we encourage the committee to pass the legislation that would prevent such an unjust result from ever happening to an Oregonian again.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Anderson. I think we understand the situation that came about. So, Ms. Shipman, if you had anything you wanted to add to what Mr. Anderson just explained, go ahead. But we are on fairly tight timing this morning, so if you don't have anything further, that's fine, too.
Well, the only thing I have to add, I think that if I probably have enough of the insurance money to last like 2.5 to 3 years, and then I would be on welfare.
Okay, that's helpful for us to understand your situation. Well, thank you very much. Are there questions for Mr. Anderson and Ms. Shipman? I see none. So shall we take you offline and continue with the other witnesses then? Mr. Anderson, do you want to remain on the line while we hear from other witnesses, or should we disconnect at this point?
I'm actually watching on real time, and so you can disconnect me, and it will be fine.
Okay, very good. Thank you for participating. Bye now.
Bye.
Okay, we have James Surface signed up.
My name is James Surface, and I'm a physical therapist, and I am the husband of Patricia Surface, who went through the judicial and as American Spirit versus Surface versus American Spirit. In other words, what I'm saying, my wife was the one that basically sent this through the court system. My wife is not here, and the reason my wife is not here is because a couple of weeks ago, we testified on this House bill. My wife sustained a traumatic brain injury in this, and she would love to be here, but basically, because of the post-traumatic stress syndrome, it took her 5 days to basically recuperate from her initial presentation to the committee, to the Consumer Committee. If you would like to basically see or hear that testimony, I would suggest that you please go to that, and you will see what a traumatic head injury would do. A little bit of history on this accident. My wife was involved with a school district 48 work vehicle, and at that time we had a $1 million insurance policy, an umbrella policy. I believe we also had an underinsured motorist of $300,000, which was required by our insurance company before they would go ahead and issue the umbrella policy. So in other words, what I'm saying is the insurance company required us to take on specific limits before they would grant an umbrella policy, and it's my understanding that's pretty much standard policy from the insurance companies. When I bought this $1 million policy, it was my impression as a consumer that if I was involved in an accident and it was my fault, the person that I injured would be entitled up to a maximum of $1 million. It was also my impression and my belief as a consumer in the state of Oregon, if I was hit by an underinsured motorist or, worse than that, an uninsured motorist, that my family and the occupants of the vehicle would be entitled to the $300,000, which was the original policy, plus, if it was decided, they would be entitled to the other $700,000, which was the umbrella policy. At the time of that accident, that was my belief. As this progressed, I was informed the state of Oregon in 1968, as was discussed by the previous attorney, passed a state immunity limit of $100,000 economic and $100,000 medical. In other words, it basically gave the state a get-out-of-jail free card, in my opinion. My attorney took this through the judicial system, and it ended up at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court held this case in limbo for 5 years. As part of our initial testimony at the Supreme Court, there was a question that one of the jurists asked. And the question that one of the jurists asked to the attorney for the insurance company, "Sir, if your insurance company was involved in an accident and this was not a public entity, would your insurance company pay?" And the attorney, after a little bit of prodding by the jurist, said, "Yes, we would. But under current Oregon law, we do not have to."
Mr. Surface, I appreciate that explanation. It's entirely consistent with what Mr. Anderson explained. Because we have limited time, I'd like to hear from some of the other witnesses here, unless you had something that took us in a different direction from what you had before.
Thank you, and I understand that. I'd like to say one more thing about this. I think you all understand what the legislation is, and the last thing that I would like to leave with you, and I said this at the last committee meeting, when you're going home tonight, each one of you have an umbrella policy. And if an e-license plate hits you and turns you into a traumatic brain injury or takes away your hands or takes away your feet, under current law, you have $100,000. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, very briefly, I sit on the Consumer Protection Committee, and I remember you and your wife being there, so thank you so much for coming back.
I appreciate this, and I hope that, thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Maybe this is not a question that you can answer, but I'm curious. You just described if an e-vehicle hits me, but what if I hit the e-vehicle? What can they sue me for?
$1 million.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Surface. John Powell and Steve Morrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. With me is Steve Burrow, an attorney with that company. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we appreciate the clarity with which this issue has been presented this morning, and do sympathize with the people who were unable to recover under the status of the law. The bill before you is a solution that reaches very few people. Most people do not have high limits. So if you pass this bill, it would affect it had been law at the time, it would affect the witnesses that you heard. But the average citizen in Oregon does not carry these high limits. Thus, this bill would not affect them. We urge this committee to consider looking at the tort liability cap as it applies only to automobile insurance. And we did find one vehicle in the committee that hasn't moved, that just relates to liability and could be a vehicle. That is the only solution that really reaches the breadth of the population in Oregon to this issue. California and Washington, our neighbors to both north and south, have no liability cap like this. The theory of tort law is to put the pressure on the person who presents the liability to act safely. A cap like this does the opposite. And what this bill would do would be to shift that liability to privately insured people instead of the person and the entity who put the vehicle on the road. So we would urge the committee to consider looking at it again, removing that cap as it would apply to automobile cases.
Mr. Merle, did you have anything to add to that before I ask a question?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I don't have anything to add to that. I'd be open to answer questions if you have them.
Very good. I appreciate the comment, and I think there's widespread recognition that our claim limits
our term claim act limits are way out of date is the most charitable thing I think one could say. But the bill before us is one that would allow people who have, those relatively few people who have purchased high limit uninsured motorist coverage, to recover under their policy. And is there anything wrong with that concept?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the concept does shift the cost from the jurisdiction who caused the wrong to insurance ratepayers. And rates are set, it's not like going into a store and buying a software for your computer and taking it home. Insurance rates are predicated upon past losses and the status of the law. So when the law changes in this case, there will be a shift of that cost onto private paying insurance, including those who buy low limits. And they get no value. And again, the only solution to this problem in the vast majority of cases is to address what causes the problem, and that is the limitation of the tort act.
Any questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can understand the concern, Mr. Paul, about shifting the responsibility to those who are truly responsible for the accident, but it seems that then you're actually promoting getting rid of uninsured motorist coverage, because the whole purpose of uninsured motorist coverage is so we can make a decision about whether we want to insure ourselves against a damage caused by somebody who doesn't have enough insurance. So it seems like consumers are making that decision to buy that coverage for that very purpose.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, the uninsured motorist coverage and underinsured motorist coverage would still be of value in case you get hit by somebody with very low limits. So it would still be a very valuable coverage.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just kind of a follow-up, I'm just concerned that if I get hit by a state vehicle today, the liability that they have is $200,000. Is that correct?
I believe that is the case.
Yeah, Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron. It's a very, Steve Merle again for the record, it's a very tortured section of statute. You have $100,000 for all damages as a first layer. And then once you use up that layer of damages, if your economic loss, your lost wages, your medical bills are enough, you have up to another $100,000 worth that you can go after. So the lady who testified this morning, she had that situation where her loss was so severe she got both of those yeah. limits.
Follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Follow up. You go ahead.
Follow up. Then I ought to have the same protection as a citizen of the state of Oregon of $200,000 liability limit. And so we either even the playing field, because I know from personal situation where a private person has hit an e-vehicle and has paid out a whole lot more than that. I just have an issue with this tort reform policy, and I think Mr. Powell's suggestion about fixing that is a good suggestion.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powell, you're suggesting that this particular bill, rather than be the focus, should be the reform of the Tort Liability Act. And would the individuals who we did hear from today be protected and be able to recover under the reform, as you mentioned?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Flores, yes, the victims that you heard from today, if there was no liability cap, would be able to have collected from the wrongdoer.
Thank you.
Clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify. I think that they would have been able to recover had that been the law when they had their accident. I'm not quite so sure they would at this time. I don't know how much time has run through. Just so that.
Well, I was. Thank you, Representative.
Clear.
I was trying to. If it had been, in fact, and so if we were to address that for similar instances
right.
in the future.
If there are no further questions, we'll excuse
Thank you, Mr.
these
Chair.
Witnesses. Neil Jackson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm going to be very short. There's a couple of things that I want to draw the committee's attention about this bill. Number one, please understand that when Mrs. Surface got injured, she had been paying premiums whereby she could have recovered. She'd already paid the premiums. The premium rates were set based on the assumption before her case came down that they would have to pay, that her insurance policy would have to pay. That was the assumption that her case went on, and it was only when the insurance company's lawyers saw a chink in the armor or a chink in the law and went ahead and took that case up. That Surface case established the fact that if it's a government vehicle. Before that, every insurance company and all the premiums were set based on the assumption by all of them that they would have to pay if it was a government vehicle that was involved, that they could make a UIM claim. So the idea that somehow rates are going to go sky high just simply is not true. It's not true at all. Again, the insurance representatives did point out to you that in these cases, it is only catastrophically injured people that this bill would affect. There are not that many of them, but the ones that there are, as you've heard today, these are real serious injuries. And even $1 million, I saw Ms. Surface testify at the hearing. I feel so bad for that woman because her brain doesn't function. She got two sentences out of her mouth, and she just got frustrated and had to stop. I feel sorry for Mr. Surface, too, and for Mr. Anderson's client. It's the people that really get hurt that should be entitled to this coverage, and I challenge that the premiums will go up that much because they were set before on the assumption that they would have to pay.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Any questions?
Mr. Jackson, if this law were to pass, would that help her? Or just future
no,
people?
No, it would only help future people. Those cases have been resolved.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief clarification. Mr. Jackson, the Surface family, I think Mr. Surface made this clear. I just want to clarify again. They had an umbrella policy as well, and they couldn't recover under that either. Is that correct?
That's what they... Okay, they had a 100-300 basic policy. And he's correct. In order to get an umbrella policy, you have to buy a 100-300 policy of every company that I know of. They require that you buy the base policy. Then they sell you the umbrella policy, which takes it from 300 up to a million. So combining their base policy with their umbrella policy, she could have recovered up to $1 million.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no further questions, I'll excuse Mr. Jackson, and we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2908 and open a work session on House Bill 2908. Committee, I would have to agree with Mr. Powell's statement that we should be doing something about our Tort Claim Act limits, but this vehicle here doesn't address that issue. It addresses the issue of whether people who've purchased insurance can actually recover under it, or because of it happening to be a public entity that caused the injury, somebody acting on behalf of a public entity, they can't, which doesn't seem right. So I would look for a motion on House Bill 2908.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Powell has indicated that there is a bill that does address that. And is that assigned to this committee and something that might be brought before us?
No, I don't think we have such a bill in our committee.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that he found something that has a similar relating clause that could be used, but it's April 17th, and we're really up against a short time frame, and I would hate to rely on that going through the process, making the big change when we have at least something we could do I don't think would be inconsistent.
Well, and even if the Tort Claim Act limits were doubled, for example, there still could be people who would purchase more insurance than what that limit is.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I would wonder if I'm buying that million-dollar policy, I'd want to know or read the policy to be sure it, you know, there's these points out, the policies point out that they don't apply if you're involved in the government or, in that situation. It's not like, buyer be warned if that's in the policies. I don't know if that's covered in normal policies that you in Oregon.
I would have to say even if it were disclosed in the policy, when people buy an uninsured, underinsured motorist policy, they don't read the fine print. They just assume if they have an accident with somebody who doesn't have adequate coverage, that they're going to be protected.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I'll just talk just briefly here. This is a fairness issue. I think that the people of the state of Oregon are being done an injustice, that if we have insurance that potentially we could recover $1 million if this is a private accident involving two private individuals, that the state of Oregon can't be held for the same liability limits that I'm going to be held as a citizen. I just think that's a wrong injustice, and to move this onto the back of private citizens because the state of Oregon is not accepting their responsibility for the liability they're incurring, I think is wrong, and I'm going to be a no vote on this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Just in response to Mr. Cameron's comments, I don't see it moving on to the back of private citizens. These are for people who actually bought the policy. They purchased the policy. And if you have a policy that you purchased to cover you, I'm just having trouble figuring out how that's moving it onto the back of private citizens, because it's you bought the policy to cover you if there was an accident, and it's not covering you.
Go ahead.
The state of Oregon has insurance, and that insurance should be paying that particular bill for that situation. The state of Oregon is not an uninsured motorist. An uninsured motorist is somebody who doesn't have insurance, and if I have insurance that is covering me for $1 million based on an umbrella policy, you know, the tort reform ought to have, I mean, the insurance that I have ought to be just as good as not equal. I mean, the state of Oregon ought to have just as good as not better insurance than I do as a private citizen. That's my point.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to add a comment that I am once again very concerned about. We have waded into an issue that should be addressed by this legislature, and by virtue of the arbitrary timeline that keeps being brought up, today is April 17th, we don't have time to do reasonable, good public policy in the best interest of the people of this state. The overview should be taken a look at the underlying problem. I'll support this bill, but I once again am troubled because we refuse to wade into doing good public policy because we have to look at the timeline.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Krieger.
Chair, I would ask that the Council take a look of the other bill having a mechanism, a relating clause that would fit this liability of the state. And I know our chair has enough influence that if he wants that before this committee, you can get it drafted. You could have it in here Monday morning. And if we want to have a look at that and make Oregon liable the same as anyone else would be, which I agree with Representative Cameron, both of these are needed in my mind.
Well, I think they're both needed, Representative. I agree with that. But what we have before us today is House Bill 2908, and we're in work session. And with the calendar moving on us, I think that we ought to take up this policy choice and address that one as well. Is there a motion on House Bill 2908?
Mr. Chair, I move 2908 to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2908 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I am concerned about the insurance company. Although these are so limited, I don't see that as being a major over anything. And somebody who has purchased an umbrella policy expecting to be covered, it'd be even if my insurance only went to $200,000 and I injured somebody at $1 million, their policy would pick it up, and it should pick it up with the state.
Any further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman.
No.
Chairman Person.
Aye.
House Bill 2908 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Bonamici, would you carry that?
I will do that. Thank
Mr.
you.
Chair, I reserve the right to file a minority report.
Okay. Very good. So noted. Close the work session on House Bill 2908 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3083. Council Kalmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3083, there are dash ones, and I think that is all that is before the committee. And what the dash ones do, they establish that when a minor has a legal claim against another person and a court has not appointed a conservator for the minor, a person with legal custody of the minor may settle the claim without court approval if, one, the amount of the claim is $25,000 or less, two, the funds are paid into a savings account in the minor's name, and three, the custodian attests that the minor will be fully compensated by the settlement or there is no practical way to obtain additional funds. Mm-hmm. The bill provides that the legal custodian is not liable to the minor for claims arising out of the settlement if he or she acts in good faith.
Mr. Murrell.
Please.
Chair, can Mr. Brooks also come up?
Yes, yes, I did.
Can
go ahead and just identify yourself for the record, please.
Vice Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Steve Murrell. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of the State Farm Group of Insurance Companies. What you have before you today is a bill that we've taken, a dash one, and the dash one would be a total replacement of the current bill. State Farm was contacted by OLA after last session about a problem that we see come up with settlements of minor children. And the problem that we have is that on some fairly modest cases, it's difficult to get the case settled without incurring a lot of expense. So what the bill before you would do would provide an expedited process for settling those claims. It's limited to claims that are $25,000. Two reasons for that limitation as far as why it's $25,000. That's the minimum financial responsibility limit for an automobile policy in the state of Oregon. It's also a small amount of money that when you settle a claim with a minor today, generally what happens is you have to employ a series of people, an attorney for the minor, a conservator, which builds layers of expense, then you have to have an account that is supervised by the court. What we find is that today when we settle those cases with that layers, it's a lot of expense for some small claims, and then the courts after a certain amount of time will want to close out that account and have it not supervised anymore. So you basically end up, I think, where this bill would put you anyway. What this bill will do is allow a claim for under $25,000 to be settled with just the protections that it's paid into a savings account in the minor's name only, and there's an attestation that basically the minor's either recovered, doesn't appear they need any more money, or there's no practical way to obtain additional funds. And then the minor just goes on their way without the layers of expense that currently are in place. Mr. Brooks actually practices in this area, so I think he may be able to share the frustrations he has sometimes.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, Brooks Cooper, you have Neil Jackson from OTLA on your witness list, but I'm testifying in his stead because this is my particular area of expertise. I've been a civil trial lawyer my entire career. I've done a lot of personal injury claims. I now handle primarily probate litigation matters, including conservatorships. What I'd like to do very quickly is outline the current practice necessitated by the state of the legislation, the problem that produces for the parties, the insurance companies, and the courts, and what this bill would do to solve that problem. Persons under 18 are by law not allowed to enter into contracts. A settlement of a personal injury claim is simply a form of contract. Therefore, when a minor has a meritorious claim that the insurance company says, you're right, our insured made a mistake, you've been damaged, we need to pay what our insured owes you, the minor can't, even if they're 17, but certainly if they're 5, 6, 8 years old, can't say, that's a great number, fine, I'll settle it in the same way that you or I could if we had that same claim. Under the current system, what we have to do is have the court appoint a conservator for the minor. The conservator is the court-sponsored, court-controlled fiduciary that we also use frequently to manage the assets of a mentally ill or a person who's gotten old enough to have senile dementia, and it's really an administrative function set up to write checks and pay bills for someone who can't do it for themselves for, assumptively, the remainder of their lives. So the minor settlement is not a very good fit in a conservatorship, because when the minor turns 18, they are of the age of majority, and they are by law entitled to this money because it is their asset. So the minor's family hires a personal injury attorney to evaluate the claim, collect the medical bills, do all the work that they do, and generally pays them on a contingent fee basis from whatever is going to be recovered. That's the normal economic model. When they get to the point that State Farm or Allstate has said, we agree with you, this claim should be settled for $9,000, $15,000, whatever the number is, they then need to employ a different attorney, because this is an entirely separate skill set that is not at all consistent with what the personal injury bar tends to do, and that's where I tend to come in. I do a lot of this work for the personal injury bar. I get paid almost always on an hourly basis because there is no risk in my representation. It's not appropriate for me to take a risk-based percentage of the money, because what I'm doing is an administrative function. I prepare a petition. I go to the court. I take time of the probate court to ask the judge, here are the facts. This looks like a reasonable settlement. Do you agree, judge? Because the judge has an oversight role. And then we have someone who is vested with the authority to finally sign the agreement, take the check. That person is the conservator. For the remainder of the time the minor is under 18, that person must file an annual accounting with the court, because all conservatorships require that. Even though not a penny of the money is being used or spent, this is not an 85-year-old person with Alzheimer's who's getting their monthly medical and their living expenses paid, and the court wants to make sure the conservator isn't wasting the money. This is a frozen account where the funds are simply accruing interest. Most of the times, the person we want to be conservator is, of course, mom or dad. We don't want to hire a professional. And many of these folks are not comfortable with the level of sophistication required to prepare these annual accountings. They come back to me every year or to some other lawyer and pay some amount of money, generally not a lot, but it gets paid out of the minor's funds to simply prove to the court that the money is still there, because the court, by statute, cannot waive that requirement. The court has to demand it. So we have conservatorship cases, imagine a 2-year-old, for 16 years, taking up time every year of the probate court, taking up time of the staff, taking up space, when that's a very cumbersome method. That's the problem. The solution represented by this bill actually takes a concept that we already have in our law that already works well. We've passed what's called the Uniform Transfers to Minors Act, which provides when someone is making a gift. Perhaps a grandpa leaves a $10,000 bond to his grandson. Normally, we would think you'd need a conservator for that as well. Under the UTMA, we have someone that we call a custodian who simply receives that. It's an outside-of-court procedure. The custodian is bound to say, this is the minor's money and I'll hold it, and they are liable if they waste it. But the court doesn't have to be involved. We don't have to get extra layers of attorney bureaucracy involved. We've taken that same idea and imported it here, where the custodian says in an affidavit or verified statement, this is a good settlement, I'm not wasting the claim, which is a requirement the conservator already has, so that's already well known to the bar in the insurance industry. That's something that everyone's familiar with. Then the money goes into account in the minor's name. When the minor turns 18, the money belongs to the minor. As a policy matter, the sponsors of the bill have made this a $25,000 limit, because there's going to come a point at which a larger claim for a more severely injured minor may be susceptible of some sophisticated management which could produce greater returns, and that's something where we might want to effectively look at a conservator. This seems to me to reduce the transactional cost of appropriately resolving claims on behalf of minors, which benefits everyone, reduces the involvement of the court system in what are otherwise a square peg, round hole fit in our current legislation, and allows all of this to be resolved in a way that is most efficient for everyone. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. thank you, Mr. Cooper, and I agree with the intent of this bill, because I know that it can be a depletion to resources and long and protracted proceedings specifically. Number one, in Section 1, talks about a minor, a person having legal custody of a minor. Wonder if there is a situation where we have a minor who perhaps is emancipated and no one has legal custody. So would they then be brought into the conservatorship process?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Representative, actually no. An emancipated minor, part of the process of emancipation, vests them with the ability to enter into contracts. They would have the same status as an adult, and this wouldn't affect them.
Thank you. A follow-up?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Did I understand you correctly to say then that the person having legal custody of the minor and having entered into this settlement agreement would also be responsible to file an annual accounting with the court?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Representative, no. That requirement is not present in this bill. This would happen, and oftentimes these claims are actually settled before litigation is filed. So in that circumstance, if I could expand, we wouldn't ever have a lawsuit, minor versus insured, but we would have to file a conservatorship. Here in that circumstance, this is settled completely without the involvement of the courts, so long as the person receiving the funds is able to swear under oath, this is a good settlement, I'm not giving up. If the case was already filed in the court, it would get settled again without the conservatorship layer, and the tort case would get dismissed in the same way an adult's tort case would be dismissed if we settled it the month before trial. But there would be no accountings.
One last follow-up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. And then, did I understand you to say also, or did I correctly understand you to say, did I understand you to say correctly, that the person who has legal custody of the minor would not have access to the funds that would be established or deposited into the account established for the minor, so there would be no jeopardy of depletion of the settlement proceeds?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative, that is the intent of this legislation, and that's in fact why the -1 amendment at 1C requires the money to be put into an account in the name of the minor alone. Under banking regulations, that generally is going to prohibit a non-account holder from accessing it in the same way that I couldn't go to your bank and get money out of your checking account because I'm not on it. That's the intent there, and the intent is that the funds are held from the date of settlement until majority. They earn whatever income they earn, and then at age 18, the minor is allowed to have that money.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, we'll excuse these witnesses and close.
Mr. Chair, just real quick. Can we open an account? Can a minor open an account without having another signer on it? Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I think this legislation is going to force that to occur if the bank wouldn't otherwise want to do it. I know from experience that there are a number of credit unions that will open passbook savings but not checking accounts for minors without having a parent signing, though the parent has to be present. I can't speak to national banks or savings and loans, but I know that that's occurred with credit unions. My thought would be that 1C would enable that to occur.
Okay, thank you. If there are no further questions, then I'll excuse these witnesses and close the public hearing on House Bill 3083 and open a work session on House Bill 3083.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1s into House Bill 3083.
Representative Barker moves the -1 amendments into House Bill 3083. Any discussion?
No, just a comment, Mr. Chair, that I fully support anything that will, as Mr. Cooper said, get rid of extra hours of attorney bureaucracy.
Very good. Any objection to the -1 amendments? Hearing none, the -1 amendments are adopted in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3083 as amended to the floor to do pass.
And actually, it's got a subsequent to Ways and Means for reasons that are not entirely clear to me. And so let's move it to Ways and Means by prior reference, subject to a rescission of that prior reference by the Speaker's office, if they so grant. Representative Barker moves House Bill 3083 as amended to the with a due pass recommendation and referral to Ways and Means by prior reference unless rescinded by the Office of the Speaker. Any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Vice
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett? Aye.
Chairman
Aye.
Motion is adopted. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3083. I'm going to jump forward because we're going to be losing some of our committee members, I understand, about 15 minutes to the work session on House Bill 2905. I'll open that work session.
Council Kalmanson, refresh us on the House Bill 2905.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2905 was first heard by this committee on March 20th and enacts the Revised Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, which provides statutory guidelines for the management, investment, and expenditure of endowment funds and the modification of restrictions on charitable funds. And just to remind you, the original version of this act was promulgated by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws in 1972 and was adopted by Oregon in 1975, and this is an updated version of that act. The dash one amendments, I think there are dash ones and dash twos for this bill, is that correct?
They are.
And that we already talked about the dash ones. It was just a technical change, but the dash twos clarify that the revised act does not apply to funds managed or invested by or on behalf of the state treasurer, but it clarifies that the provisions relating to the modification or release of restrictions contained in gift instruments also apply to property given to the state by private donors.
Very good. And I know we had several people who looked like they came with interest in this bill. Any reason you need to come and talk to us about it? Okay. Looks like everybody's fine with the dash one and dash twos, right? I see nodding in the back of the room. So, do I hear a motion on the dash one and dash two amendments, which could be handled together? Ms. Kump, why don't you offer
yes,
that motion?
Yes, Chairman Ferguson, I move to add dash ones and dash twos into House Bill 2905.
Representative Kump moves the dash one and dash two amendments into House Bill 2905. Any discussion of that motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Did the George Fox University concern get addressed in the dash council? We had... one item appears to be missing in the proposed legislation is very important to charitable organizations. House Bill 2905, Section 5.1 addresses situations where the consent of the donors can be obtained. Da 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 da. And so forth. Do you have that one?
I do not.
Do we know if that was addressed?
Mr. Shetterly, could you address the question that Representative Wisnett just asked?
I sure can. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lane Shetterly, representing the Oregon delegation to the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. I can answer that, and actually it's addressed in the bill. You may have heard, recall testimony from the institutional nonprofit organizations that were represented uniformly endorsing and supporting this bill. The letter from that you've received this morning raised the question, well, what about modification in the event of the death of a donor? That actually is covered in Section 5. Section 5 provides for two paths for modification. Subsection 1 in sub 5 is predicated on consent of the donor. Obviously, that is when the donor is alive and able to consent. Subsections 2, 3, and 4 are methods to obtain modification when the donor is not able to consent. If you look on, I'm trying to think where it is. It's on page 4, and in fact, Susan Gary's testimony that should be in your bill file from the first hearing addressed this, where she said, thank you, Kate Richardson, on page 3 of her testimony, she says, discussing release or modification, it says, the donor may consent to the restriction if the donor is still alive and able to do so, but if the donor is not available, the charity can ask a court for approval of a modification of the restriction. So that concern really is already addressed in the bill, and I'll make sure that the representatives from the charitable organizations that testified in support of the bill get in touch with the author of this letter and clarify to him that his concern is addressed in the bill.
Very good. Any further questions of Mr. Shetterly or further discussion of the motion on the dash one and dash two amendments? If there's no further discussion, is there any objection to the adoption of the dash one and dash two amendments? Hearing none, then those amendments are adopted and are in the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kump.
I move that House Bill 2905 including the amendments of the dash ones and the dash two, be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Comp moves the House Bill 2905 as amended by the dash one and dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 2905 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Comp, would you carry that
sure,
bill?
Sure, absolutely.
Great. Thank you. I will now close the work session on House Bill 2905. And we'll go back to our last, probably the last public hearing we're going to get to today is on House Bill 3084. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3084. Council Kalmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3084 increases to $10,000 the maximum amount that a plaintiff may seek in tort actions in which the court must award attorney fees if the plaintiff first provides the defendant or its insurer a written demand for payment 10 days before the action is initiated. The bill establishes that the written demand must include either a copy of the plaintiff's medical records and bills or documentation of the amount of damages to the property, depending on the circumstances and the nature of the action. The bill repeals provision requiring a court to award attorney's fees to a prevailing defendant if the defendant had pleaded a counterclaim.
Very good. Neil Jackson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association to speak in favor of this bill. What we've tried to do in this bill is address some problems that have arisen. This statute, the attorney's fees statute, has been around since the 40s. I did some research on it yesterday. Back in 1950, the limit of the claim that could be made where attorney's fees could be requested was $500. Since it's been raised, obviously, it's now $5,500. My research indicates that the last raise was in the year 2000. I did a calculation based on the $500 in 1950, what the limit of the claim would be now. 761% inflation. It's just huge. It's $380,000. Obviously, we don't want that much. The purpose of the statute was to allow smaller claims to set them up so that they could be settled without the necessity of a lawsuit being filed. What you do is if you've got a claim under current law for $5,500 or less, you send a demand letter to the defendant, and as a matter of routine, you also send it to their insurance company. If they do not pay within 10 days and you file a lawsuit, then you're entitled to attorney's fees to be set by the court if you, the plaintiff, prevail. A couple of problems have arisen that this bill addresses. One of the problems is we think the reason for the increase is that in a lot of property damage cases, and I handle quite a few of them, we're running into situations because of the $5,500 limit. We'll have an $8,900 documented property damage claim. And the plaintiff in that case, the party with the injured property, is faced with the choice of either go for the full $8,900, which if you take attorney's fees out of that, do it on a contingency basis, they're not going to come out with net $5,500. So what they're doing is they're giving up a big portion of their claim and lowering their demand to $5,500 because they want to make sure that they're netting out as good as they can. So anything above $5,500, the consumer is having to lower their claim in order to make sure that at least they net out to $5,500. That's on the plaintiff's side. On the defense side, one of the problems that recurs, and some of my brethren and sistren in the plaintiff's bar are doing this, and I don't do it. Most of my brethren and sistren don't do it, but there are some attorneys that are sending a demand letter and are not providing any records, any substantiation of the claim. If you know anything about the way insurance companies operate, if they just get a letter from an attorney saying, I want this much money without any documentation of the claim, they can't write a check. They simply can't, because they've got to have proof in their file that this claim is worth whatever the demand is, in this case $5,500. And some plaintiff's attorneys are just sending the letter to trap the insurance companies into having to pay attorney's fees once they file a suit. And I don't think that's right, and that's part of the trade-off in this bill. It solves that problem because this bill requires that they provide medical bills, medical records, or if it's a property damage claim, they've got to give an appraisal or an estimate of the property damage at the time that they send that 10-day demand letter, so that the insurance adjuster has something to look at. So if they want to pay on the claim and they think it's a legitimate claim, they can do it. So we've tried to address all of those issues, and we've established we would like it to be set at $10,000. And I will tell the committee, the one section that takes out a prevailing counterclaim, we've got no problem with that is put back in the bill. We don't have a problem with that.
Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jackson, there's a comment in our staff measure summary, and maybe our committee counsel can clarify this. It says that even though it takes out the counterclaim provision because a defendant who brings a counterclaim is simply a plaintiff, that a prevailing defendant would be entitled to attorney fees if in compliance. Do you interpret that the same way?
Yeah, if the counterclaim, it's the same language that was in the statute before. If a defendant brings a counterclaim and they prevail on the counterclaim on an attorney's fees case under this statute, they would be entitled to attorney's fees because they do, in effect, become a plaintiff because of the counterclaim.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Jackson, in your example, in your written testimony and in your oral testimony, you cited an example where a claim would be made for $8,900, mm-hmm. and then after attorney's fees, it would be substantially less. And are you talking about then the attorney's fees calculated on
a contingency of the amount recovered?
And yes. The percentage. So at what point for this type of claim, or at what level, what rate, what percentage are we talking about here?
Well, I'm making the assumption that it goes all the way through litigation, because the most common attorney's fees are structured, whereas if the case is settled before it goes to arbitration or trial, the attorney's fee is one-third of the recovery. If it does go to arbitration or trial, fees commonly go to 40%.
Follow-up.
Go ahead.
Thank you, and I've heard them go higher than 40% too. But for the sake of discussion, then at $8,900 in damages at 30%, not quite 33 1/3, we're talking about recovery to the claimant at $6,230.
Right.
At 40%, we're talking about recovery to the plaintiff of $5,340.
Correct.
So that's pretty near the $5,500 mark.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from Steve Murrell and John Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies, and with me is Mr. Murrell, the legal counsel in the claims department for the company. Mr. Chairman, I'll just turn this over in recognition of the time limitations and let Mr. Murrell go through our objections to the bill.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, again, my name is Steve Murrell. I'm a claim attorney for State Farm Insurance Companies. Our main concerns with this bill is that it basically expands the threshold so to the point where I think 90% of the claims that we would handle in the Oregon Division for State Farm would be subject to this. What that does for us is it gives us concern that I've seen an uptick in activity in the use of this statute, and I think that as you incentivize it with a higher threshold, you're going to see more of this statute being used. We're also concerned that the counterclaim provision is dropped. I heard there's no objection to that. I'd like to see that put back in. Also, to clarify, I'm not sure if Representative Bonamici's question was what happens to the defendant when they don't have a counterclaim. This is a one-way statute. The person bringing the claim gets their fees. If you resist a claim that wasn't meritorious, you pay your own attorney and get nothing but the warm, fuzzy feeling that you were right. And that's a manifestly unfair scheme, I think, that has been put into the statute. As the limit expands, I think that's something that should be reexamined. With that, if there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Are there any questions for either of these witnesses?
Chair and members of the committee, again, John Powell for the record. I just want to say for the record there are many other business interests who oppose that, and I think Mr. Miller is going to in his testimony talk to some of those. But this is not just an insurance issue. It is an issue with slip and falls and every other kind of situation that business faces every day. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, gentlemen. Next, a panel of Lana Butterfield, John Clements, and Beth Reeves.
Well, I was just checking to see if
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here on behalf of Safeco. Safeco appreciates what our previous witness says so much that we usually let them say it, but on this bill we care very strongly, and so that's why you're seeing two folks who work daily in these kind of issues here testifying. I'm going to let John Clements go give our main testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Clements. I've been with Safeco Insurance Company for 25 years, all in the claims side of things, and have worked with this statute for all of these years in some form or another. Customers and claims representatives are already inherently motivated to settle small property and bodily injury claims for quickly and for a fair amount. Otherwise, claims representatives would be faced with ever-increasing pending, and there would also be a significant decrease in customer service. At the current $5,500 level, the threat of attorney fees already forces claims representatives to offer more than what the claim may otherwise be worth. And if they're wrong in their assessment, then they also face the exposure of attorney fees on an hourly basis, and that exposure can be significantly more than what the small claim was worth originally. So a $1,000 claim could have, say, $10,000 in attorney fees by the time it goes through the litigation process. And if the claims adjuster is correct in his or her evaluation, then there are no prevailing party fees awarded to the defendant. So it's a one-sided thing only. The bill encourages litigation rather than removes it because attorney fees just don't come into play unless a lawsuit is filed. And it also discourages a prompt settlement because it discourages it because attorney fees have yet to be incurred, and so as time goes on, the attorney fees are going to be built up and the recovery may be more substantial than it would otherwise be if the claim settled right away. So in sum, 20.080 increases the cost of doing business, and that cost is then ultimately borne by all of us who purchase the insurance product. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Clements. Ms. Reeves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Reeves. I am an attorney with Safeco Insurance Company. I've been there since 1993. Before that, I was in private practice, and I did work as a plaintiff's attorney at one point. So I have handled 20.080 cases from both sides. I agree with Mr. Clements that this increase is not warranted and it would increase litigation. An award of attorney fees is the exception in Oregon. It's not the rule. And in looking at this bill and even with the changes that's made, it's not meeting the original purpose of ORS 20.080, which was to encourage claims to settle before a lawsuit was filed.
some of the things I want to point out specifically in this. For instance, on subsection 3, documentation is not required. It is only required if it is in the plaintiff's possession or reasonably available to the plaintiff at the time of the demand. There is a 2-year statute of limitations on bodily injury claims, 6 years on property damage. If that documentation isn't available by then, it's unreasonable to expect an insurance company or a defendant to be able to evaluate a claim, particularly if this amount was to be increased up to $10,000. This provision should be mandatory. It should not be only if it's reasonably available. I see time after time when there is some excuse why documentation isn't available. We can't evaluate the claim. Another issue I have is that if you notice, attorney fees are mandatory. It says they shall be taxed and allowed. Our office has had a case in which a $5 bill the other thing I want to say is whether a plaintiff prevails is determined as of the date of the litigation, what the complaint says on the date of the litigation. We have had a case in which a demand was made. Safeco made an offer at X dollars about 2 weeks before the arbitration, and so several months after the lawsuit was filed, a $5 bill copying charge was found. That $5 was at the plaintiff asked for the complaint to be amended to add that $5. The arbitrator allowed it, and so our offer was beaten by $5. The plaintiff attorney in that case got between $5,000 and $10,000 in attorney fees because of that $5 difference. I would suggest that committee consider that attorney fees either be discretionary in a situation like that, or that reciprocal attorney fees be allowed. A defendant is not allowed attorney fees if the defendant prevails or if the plaintiff continues with the litigation. 10 days. One more point. 10 days is also a very short period of time in which for a defendant to be able to evaluate a larger claim. Thank you. And I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Reeves. It appeared to me that while this is a little more than an inflationary adjustment from the last time this amount was adjusted, that the thrust of the comments from all three of you are that the policy choices reflected in the statute being amended are ones that you don't support. That is, that if the dynamics surrounding this provision of the law, regardless of its level of dollars, don't work right. Is that a fair sort of understanding of what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Chair, it seems to me pretty unreasonable that we're going to go ahead and award fees one way and not the other. I think the testimony, I tend to agree with it, would encourage claims to linger a bit and go on, I think that would be detrimental.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any further questions or comments, Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and to the panel. Anybody can answer this, but I know Mr. Clements made a comment about hourly attorneys' fees. What portion of these claims are handled by attorneys charging by the hour, and what portion are by contingency?
I'd like to answer that. I believe most of these are taken by the attorneys on an hourly basis. Because the contingency in the smaller claims would be, say, on a $1,000 claim, a contingency would only be $300. But by billing on an hourly basis, which the courts have allowed, then if the litigation goes on for weeks or months, then the fees will be substantially higher.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, may I address that question? It's been my experience that in any attorney fee award case, the award have been on an hourly basis.
Okay. If there are no further questions, I'll excuse this panel, and we have one last witness signed up, Sean Miller.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America, PCI, here today in opposition to House Bill 3084. I'll be real brief, Mr. Chairman. I won't repeat anything that's been said by the other panel, but I would like to add that this is not just an insurance issue. It is a business issue, especially a small business issue, when you consider the what is considered a small damage claim, and the inflation of raising from $5,500 to $10,000 will affect many small businesses in the state. I've been given the authority just to list on the record, Mr. Chairman, the concerns from the Oregon Restaurant Association, the Northwest Grocery Association, National Federation of Independent Business, as well as the Associated Oregon Industries. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll just end my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Any questions? Very good. Thank you for your participation, Mr. Miller.
I have a question for counsel. Did we earlier in the session increase the small claims limit? We passed a bill on addressing that.
I think we did.
It's not coming to mind.
Okay.
I think we moved it to 7,500.
I think we moved it up.
I think we did.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3084. And although we're in a bare quorum, I'm not going to have intended to bring this bill to a work session today. I'm going to open just briefly a public hearing on 2833, but not right. For the purpose. Exactly. Actually, Representative Barker, not forgetting an explanation. Representative Barker? No, just open a public hearing, because I want to get the 72-hour notice out of the way so we can notice it within 48 hours. But I think you want to be able to make the presentation to more than half the committee. And also, I got slipped a note by Mr. DeLashment saying that there was an amendment that he thought ought to be, or a further revision in the amendments to the bill that ought to be prepared. And don't explain the substance, just confirm that there are further amendments that need to be made.
For the record, Brian DeLashment, representing the Oregon Council Police Association. In consultation with a representative from the DPSSK and looking at the Dash 1 amendments, there appears that there needs to be a technical change and a Dash 2 amendment so that we don't have some contradictory on the repeal of one section as far as designee and then another section in which it, in fact, lays out a process for a designee. So,
very good. Okay.
We're happy to set it over
with that input. Then what I'm going to do is close the public hearing, which means we will have gone through our 72-hour notice, and on a 48-hour notice, when that amendment is prepared, we can get it set up on the agenda again.
Thank you.
So I will close the public hearing then on House Bill 2833. That concludes our agenda, members. Thank you very much. We're adjourned.